The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin back with the wake-up call on a Monday morning, the 21st of June, which is, of course, the same time, but the evening in Singapore. So I am glad to be with you, and I just wanted to point out that before we start, if anybody is of a mind to call in, the number has changed. The call-in number has changed to 888-874-4888. That's our new number as of about 2 to 3 weeks. Please make note and please use it. It's there for your every wish, and so if you want to have those wishes come true, that's to say your questions answered, then please call that number and we will do our level best. Well, one of the biggest risks to the world's financial health is the 1.2 quadrillion derivatives market. It's complex, it's unregulated, and it ought to be of concern to world leaders that its notional value is 20 times the size of the world economy. But traders rule the roost, and as much as risk managers and regulators might want to limit that risk, they lack the power or knowledge to do so. A quadrillion is a big number, ladies and gentlemen. That is 1,000 times a trillion. Yet according to one of the world's leading derivatives experts, Paul Wilmot, who holds a doctorate in applied mathematics from Oxford University, and by the way, whose speaking voice sounds eerily like John Lennon's, $1.2 quadrillion is the so-called notional value of the worldwide derivatives market. Now, to put that in perspective, the world's annual gross domestic product is between $50 trillion and $60 trillion. To understand the concept of notional value, it's useful to have an example. Let's say you borrow $1 million to buy an apartment, and the interest rate on that loan gets reset every 6 months. Meanwhile, you turn around and rent that apartment out at a monthly fixed rate. If all your expenses, including interest, are less than the rent, you make money. But if the interest and expenses get bigger than the rent, you lose. You might be able to hedge this risk of a spike in interest rates by swapping that variable rate of interest for a fixed one. To do that, you'd need to find a counterparty who has an asset with a fixed rate of return, who believed that interest rates were going to fall, and was willing to swap his fixed rate for your variable one. The actual cash amount of the interest rate swaps might be 1% of the $1 million debt, while that $1 million is the notional amount. Applying that same 1% to the $1.2 quadrillion derivatives market would leave a cash amount of the derivatives market of $12 trillion, far smaller, but still 20% of the world economy. How big is the risk to the world economy from these derivatives? Well, according to Wilmot, it's impossible to know unless you understand the details of the derivatives contracts. But since they're unregulated and likely to remain so, it's hard to gauge the risk. But Wilmot gives an example of an over-the-counter customized derivative that could be very risky indeed, and could also put its practitioners in a position of what he called moral hazard. Suppose Bank One and Bank Two decide to hedge against the risk that Bank Three and Bank Four might fail to repay their debt to Bank One and Bank Two. To guard against that, Bank One and Bank Two might hedge the risk through derivatives. In so doing, Bank One and Bank Two might buy a credit default swap on Bank Three and Bank Four debt. The credit default swap would pay Bank One and Bank Two if Bank Three and Bank Four failed to repay their loan. Bank One and Bank Two might also bet on the decline in shares of Bank Three and Bank Four through a short sale. At that point, any action that Bank One and Bank Two might take to boost the odds that Bank Three and Bank Four might default would increase the value of their derivatives. That possibility might tempt Bank One and Bank Two to take actions that would boost the odds of failure for Bank Three and Bank Four. This kind of behavior, in which hedge funds pulled out their money out of banks whose stock they were shorting, may have contributed to the failures of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. It's also the sort of conduct that makes it extremely difficult to estimate the risk of the derivatives market. Another kind of market conduct that makes market volatile is what Will calls positive and negative feedback loops. These relatively bland-sounding items mask some really scary behavior for investors who are not clued into it. Wilmot argues that a positive feedback loop contributed to the 22.6% crash in the Dow back in October 1987. In the 1980s, a firm run by some former academics came up with the idea of portfolio insurance. Their idea was that if investors are worried about their assets losing value, they can buy puts, the option to sell their investments at a predetermined price. They can sell everything, which would be embarrassing if the market then started to rise, or they could sell a fixed proportion of their portfolio, depending on the percentage decline in a particular stock market index. This idea is portfolio insurance. If the Dow, for example, fell 3%, it might suggest that investors should sell 20% of their portfolio. And if the Dow fell 20%, it would indicate that investors should sell 100% of their portfolio. That positive feedback loop, in which a stock price decline leads to more selling, boosts market volatility. Portfolio insurance causes more investors to sell as the market declines by, say, 3%, which causes an even deeper plunge in the value of investors' holdings. And that deeper decline leads to more selling. Before you know it, many investors are selling everything. The portfolio insurance firm started off with $5 billion, but as its reputation spread, it ended up managing $50 billion. In 1987, that was a lot of money. So when that positive feedback loop got going, it took the Dow down 22.6% in a day. The big problem back then was the absence of a sufficient number of traders using a negative feedback loop strategy. With a negative feedback loop, a trader would sell stocks. As they rose and buy them as they declined. With a negative feedback loop strategy, volatility would be far lower. Unfortunately, data on how much money has been going into negative and positive feedback loop strategies is not available. Therefore, it's hard to know how the positive feedback loops have gained such a hold on the market. But it's not hard to imagine that if a particular investor made huge amounts of money following a positive feedback loop strategy, other investors would hear about it and copy it. Moreover, the way traders get compensated suggests that it's better for them to take more and more risk to replicate what their peers are doing. There is a clear economic incentive for traders to follow what their peers are doing. According to Wilmot, to understand why, it helps to imagine a simplified example of a trading floor. Picture yourself as a new college graduate joining a bank's trading floor with 100 traders. Those 100 traders each trade $10 million. They win if a coin toss lands on heads and lose if it lands on tails. But now imagine you've come up with a magic coin that has a 75% chance of landing heads. You could make a better bet than the other 100 traders with their 50-50 coin. You might think that the best strategy for you would be to put your bet of $10 million on that magic coin. But you'd be wrong. According to Wilmot, if the magic coin lands on a head but the other 100 traders flip tails, the bank loses $1 billion while you get a relatively paltry $10 million. The best possible outcome for you is a 37.5% chance that everyone makes money. The 75% chance of you losing heads multiplied by the 50% chance of the other traders getting ahead. If instead you use the same coin as everyone else on the floor, the probability of everyone getting a bonus rises to 50%. Traders are a huge source of profit on Wall Street these days, and they have incentive to bet together and to bet big. According to Wilmot, traders get a bonus based on the one-year profits of those on their trading floor. If the trading floor makes big money, all the traders get a big bonus. And if it loses money, they get no bonus, but at least they don't have to repay their capital providers for the losses. Given that bonus structure, a trader is always better off risking $1 billion than $1 million. So if the trader, who is the king of the hill at the bank, asks a lowly risk manager to analyze how much risk the trader is taking, that risk manager is on the spot. If the risk manager comes back with a risk level that limits how big a bet the trader can take, the trader will demand that the risk manager recalculate the risk level lower so the trader can take the bigger bet. Traders also manipulate their bonuses by assuming the existence of trading profits before they are actually realized. This happens when traders get involved with derivatives that will not unwind for 20 years. Although the profits or losses on that trade have not been realized at the end of the first year, the bank will make an assumption about whether that trade made or lost money each year. Given power traders wield, they could meet the number of come out positive so they can receive a hefty bonus, even though it's too early to tell what the real outcome of the trade will be. Wilmot imagines that this greater incentive to follow the pack is what happened when many traders were piling into collateralized debt obligations. In Wilmot's view, CDO risk managers who had analyzed a future scenario in which housing prices fell and interest rates rose would have concluded that the CDOs would become worthless under that scenario. He imagines that when notified of that possible outcome, BDO traders would have demanded that the risk managers shred that nasty scenario so they could keep trading more CDOs. Incidentally, the traders who profited by going against the CDO crowd were lone wolves whose compensation did not depend on following the trading floor pack. This reinforces the idea that big bank compensation policies drive dangerous behavior that boosts market volatility. Will believes that derivatives represent a risk of unknown proportions. But unless there is a change to trader compensation policies, one which would force traders to put their compensation at risk for the life of the derivative, then this risk could remain difficult to manage. Unfortunately, he thinks that regulators aren't in a good position to assess the risks of derivatives because they don't understand them. Wilmot offers training in risk management. While traders and risk managers at banks and hedge funds have taken his course, regulators so far have not. And if regulators don't understand the risks in derivatives, chances are great that Congress doesn't understand them either. Okay, I'm Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call. And as I said, the call-in number, which is toll-free to you and me and everybody else on the planet, is 888-874-4888. Once more, the new toll-free number is 888-874-4888. And if you prefer to write in your questions and comments, you may do so by writing to my email address, which is currently open, and it is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. And, of course, as always, if you would like to call me personally and get some advice from the horse's mouth, you may do so by calling my direct line in Sarasota, which will be transported across to Singapore at no expense to you. And the number to call is area code 941-441-1682. Once more, 941-441-1682. All right. Well, nobody can spend his or way to prosperity, whether they are an individual investor, a Fortune 500 company, or a sovereign state with a Keynesian enthusiast at the helm. Debts must eventually be repaid or defaulted on. It's a case of what goes up, etc., etc. But no matter how solid the laws of gravity may be, there will always be men who try to subvert them. Skydivers refer to such men as casualties. Politicians refer to them as modern-day economists. Ben Bernanke is one such man. When asked the other day whether the U.S. economy would likely suffer a double-dip recession, Bernanke replied, My best guess is we'll have a continued recovery, but it won't feel terrific. As we can tell, Mr. Bernanke has missed the point entirely. He assumes that the economy is recovering. It is not. He sees a renewed enthusiasm among consumers, which is in itself dubious at best and waning at worst, as bricks on the road, land of milk and honey. So far this year, the news is pretty good, he said. We've seen consumers coming back. But consumers are not coming back, at least not in any kind of sustainable manner. Wages are going down, hours are being cut, credit is contracting. And even if they were coming back, what on earth are they spending? They have no money. Secondly, the private debts of yore have not been repaid. They have merely been collectivized and dumped onto the public books. They are still the same debts as they always were. Only now they are much bigger, threatening to drag entire nations asunder instead of poorly managed private institutions. See, ladies and gentlemen, the problem is this. The die have been cast, and the only possible result is an ever fiercer spiral of fiscal consolidation, with the effects of the spiraling economies ever deeper into depression. The trouble is that having splurged in the wake of the financial crisis, having simultaneously strained fiscal positions towards breaking point, there is nowhere left to go. Had it been the case that only a few small economies had built up so much debt, the world economic system might have been able to absorb the retrenchment, albeit with some pain. However, this is not what happened. And the collective market awakening to the risks of sovereign debt cannot be turned back. Even Japan, with its willing army of domestic savers, is twitching. Then there is the U.S., with the safe haven and reserve currency status, The U.S. has chosen to remain on the path of ongoing growth in debt and spending. There is further talk of even more fiscal stimuli. The U.S. is getting into ever deeper trouble, all the time relying on the safe haven and reserve status to last to eternity. I've already discussed the risks in being perceived as a safe haven, and this is the latest news on the U.S. trade situation. The U.S. trade deficit rose to the highest level in 16 months, as exports fell for the second time in 3 months, a potentially worrisome sign that Europe's debt troubles are beginning to crimp American manufacturers. The Commerce Department said on Thursday that the trade deficit widened to $40.3 billion in April. That's up by 0.6% from March. U.S. exports dropped 0.6%, while imports declined by 0.4%. U.S. manufacturing has been a standout performer as the U.S. recovers from the worst recession in decades. But the concern is that Europe's debt crisis will slow growth in that part of the world and dampen demand in a key U.S. export market. For April, exports slipped to $148.8 billion, with demand for U.S. farm products falling by $647 million and weakness spread across a number of manufactured goods, from electric generators to industrial machinery and aircraft engines. This latest news serves to highlight the dangers that I already described, i.e. that the safe haven status is a danger to the U.S. economy. Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. is in very deep trouble. And the safe haven and reserve currency status are encouraging them deeper into a quagmire. As long as the world keeps buying treasuries, they seem willing to keep deepening the fiscal hole, all the while importing and consuming based upon debt growth. At some stage, the markets must realize that the beauty of the U.S. has faded and that in reality it is looking both tired and haggardly. The trouble is, the U.S. is still deeply entrenched in the neo-Keynesian dream. In the worst of the neo-Keynesians, the answer is not to consolidate but to continue government borrowing to prevent a choking of recovery. No doubt, in the future, as the inevitable consequences of the consolidation take place, they will blame the problem on the fiscal consolidation rather than on the fiscal splurge and consumer debt splurge that preceded it. This despite the fact that this borrowing and spending was supporting an economic structure that could not be sustained, and that the choices of borrowing of the scale needed to support a continuation was becoming impossible. And that is the problem with their solutions, that they can never be proved wrong, as whatever it's done, it always necessitates more to be done. If the fiscal stimulus runs out of steam, have another one, and another one, and another one. If it isn't working, a larger one will do the trick. If the larger one doesn't do the trick, then there's an even larger one that might just do the trick. If nobody will lend, print money. If that doesn't work, just print more. The solutions have been just tried, and the result is what we see before us. Massive fiscal stimuli have been tried. Quantitative easing, printing money. To fund the government debt has been tried. And despite this, the economic crisis just keeps coming back. The difference now is that we can see where these policies have left the world economy, on the edge of a cliff. They cannot claim that the problem is a market failure, as any reasonable economic theory must account for the actuality of markets. That actuality is quite reasonable. The markets think that if they continue to lend to the major debtor governments, they will not have their money repaid in real terms, or it will not be paid due to default. The markets have recognized that there is no clear plan for how the ongoing debt accumulation and repayment of debt might be achieved or sustained. Despite all the money flooding into the U.S., the safe haven, the doubts about the sustainability of the neo-Keynesian approach are mounting. It's only a matter of time before the markets confront the U.S. with the commencement of fiscal retrenchment elsewhere and the drive for deeper austerity measures, eventually the markets will turn more cynical eyes upon the U.S. economy. And by that time, the U.S. will be even deeper in the quagmire of debt. Why don't I summarize the position this way? Just as the consumer debt spiraled and unwound, sovereign debt has replaced that debt and must eventually unwind. The nature and the speed of that unwinding is still uncertain. The politicians and policymakers have still yet to fully play their hands, and they will be confronted with resistance from their populations as they seek to win that beauty contest. Set against the governments will be the bond markets, the judges in beauty, least ugly, competition. Furthermore, in the tangled world of mutual dependency of one economy upon other economies, it is still uncertain where the really weak players in the world economy might be. As the debt accumulation goes into reverse, the dependencies will start to become apparent and may present some surprising outcomes. However, one thing is certain. Whatever the eventual outcome, no country is going to come to the progressive fiscal consolidation untouched. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got lots of mail, and I am going to tackle it, and also hopefully some of your live questions after the break. So I think we will take that break right now, and as soon as we come, we shall launch into some of these questions which have been building up over about 2 or 3 weeks. Okay, so see you in a moment.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Ellen Kamai, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Zig. Dr. Eugene Zamperone and I have been deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combined traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN from 1 to 2 p.m. every Monday. We'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, yourselves, and your family. Tune in to Progressive Radio Network every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or anytime by visiting the archives. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew, which airs on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. My show interviews fascinating authors, inventors, and researchers of new understandings, techniques, and discoveries that can enhance and transform our lives. What is our potential and how can we fulfill it to the max? To find out, tune in to Energy Stew and Peter Roth at 8 p.m. Thursdays on Progressive Radio Network.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
Okay, we're back, and we shall start with a an email from Bo Atkinson, who says, "Lovely nostalgia you bring back to us, or was it that fettered world we once knew? Today, youthful consciousness is foiled by the nearly limitless web of thought. Or so it may seem, if we cannot know exactly where to look. Certainly the bread and circuses might not be the best area to behold. I suggest one also study the large variety of social networks and recall that all of youth cannot be blamed. For the critical mass of passions and the malnourished ductless glands brought to shame. An analyst needs step back and at the least hope markets will renew innovation. As to the larger questions of inflation versus deflation, is it not normal to respire? May cultures not sneeze once in a while? Or gasp as a frog who floats upon a jaw full of air? Float forward to best that other challenging frog who dares. Why must investors always flock to the fittest ego apparent? The one on top of the pile, acting so arrogant. That investments small may be beautiful, and that a small size is not so futile." Bo, did you translate that into Shakespearean? It's very nice sounding. I hope you all understood it. I come to moments when I did sort of falter a bit in my intellectual grasp, but Bo, it sounds great. So please keep up the good work, and more of the same. Keep it short, that's all. Okay. Frank, we come to you now. Frank, who says as follows, "Richard, as the economy continues to spew forth a toxic financial sheen from low housing starts to unpaid mortgages, shipwrecked commercial real estate, record unemployment, a nuclear winter for state finances, vanishing availability of bank loans to small businesses, and depleted social aid, our sock puppet leader declares, the economy is getting stronger by the day. By that logic, the Gulf must be getting cleaner by the day. To be fair, the Gulf is changing, and I do believe it. The Spinmeister, with the help of multiple teleprompters, will soon be telling us that the Gulf is getting cleaner. I suppose one has to consider that when you kill off the bird and fish populations, along with the tourists, you don't have to contend with their droppings. A pity the slick can't reach Congress, and then we wouldn't have to contend with their droppings. From the foxhole, oil-free so far, Frank." Thanks, Frank. Pithy as usual. Enjoyed it. And now we come to Stephen's email, which is lengthy and requires you, ladies and gentlemen, to take a seat, settle back, and enjoy what follows. This comes from Stephen, and I start out, as he does, with "Dear Richard. As a long-time listener, I would like to respond to the essay read on last Friday's show concerning America and Americans. I would have to agree almost entirely with the writer's evaluation and applaud his insight. However, I would like to take this all up a notch and propose that what your guest was talking about is not limited to the American way, but is, when examined a bit more closely, a fundamental aspect of the human condition. If I may, please let me begin by plugging my book, now available at Amazon.com and entitled The Big Book About Nothing, so as to give you some credibility to what is to follow and a resource your listeners can go to for more information and perhaps gather some hope for better things to come. Again, ladies and gentlemen, the title, The Big Book About Nothing. In that book, there is much attention paid to the phenomenon of ego and the barrier it creates to a truer, more meaningful understanding of ourselves and this life we have all been gifted with. Our egocentric identity has been around since one of us had the wherewithal to have a look at themselves and conclude, there I am. That identity would grow exponentially as we discovered we and us and put labels on that experience. For most, the why and how to our existence was far beyond our egoic interpretation of life, and so were either ignored or myths built around them. A far more evolved sense of self would have to develop before those important questions could be explored in earnest, and so answered in the light of higher consciousness. But the egoic mindset, in spite of all its flaws and restrictions, would be the catalyst for the expansion of human intelligence and the growth of awareness, due primarily to its underlying innate insecurity and its inherent need to know. Herein lies the flaw mentioned above, for within that egoic perspective, whatever identity man would come to know himself by was, for all intents and purposes, simply made up, based almost entirely on relative circumstance in what I refer to as a mind-based arena it alone was responsible for, one that was and continues to be isolated from and in ignorance of the very source of life that has made our existence possible. Be that as it may, as we explored the world, gathered information, and so raised our awareness beyond the confines of a purely animal-like existence, civilization would find its roots in Europe and in Asia as man's burgeoning, often chaotic, and certainly limited egoic identity began to manifest in the physical world. The course of human history consistently reflects our need for more than and the powerful desire to be free, the human spirit be suppressed, and the limits and restrictions of the egoic mind had manifest in religious dogma and political tyranny would be rejected as mankind left the well-established and somewhat constipated European landscape and set off to find his freedom and the hope for a better life in the Americas. As the long arm of English tyranny made efforts to keep its hold on this growing spirit, the American Revolution would be fought to secure the inalienable right of every human being to be free. With the help of unlimited resources, the God-given creative intelligence inherent in the human spirit, and the freedom given to its people by its people to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, this country was in its early stages a place of great opportunities, a panacea for egoic survival, and the hallmark in the growth of human ingenuity. It attracted untold numbers of human beings in search of a better and more fulfilling life. Many great accomplishments were achieved. Huge advances in technology, medicine, and an understanding of the world around us were made. Slowly but surely, institutions were established to monitor, control, and secure our growing economy as a new, exciting, and more energetic way of life would rise out of the wilderness. Nothing, it seemed, could stop us. But alas, ego is, as the noted writer-lecturer Julius Lester suggests, an insatiable tick. If it is not killed, it can burrow under the layers of the soul and feed upon the man within, gorging itself until there is no man left. End of quote. Our egoic need for more did indeed begin gorging itself as it mutated the innate drive for being and our interpretation of what happiness meant into an unprecedented blight upon the earth. We slaughtered the noble indigenous people and laid waste their way of life to make way for a misguided, unrelenting need to be and to have more. Likened to an out-of-control freight train, the momentum of our perversions could not be stopped. Greed, corruption, fear, and the insidious ideologies that power must create to survive have driven us to the brink of destruction. At this point, there doesn't seem to be anything that can have us avoid the inevitable crash and burn that lies, as you have so passionately predicted, very near ahead. So is that it? Is America simply destined to fade away, another of the great societies that will collapse upon itself? There can be little doubt that this country and its people are about to go through horrific times. Sadly, we are not all driven by fear, greed, and corruption, and some of what the best humanity has to offer lies within these borders. But as a nation, we have clearly lost our way. The falsehood of the egoic mindset can no longer be tolerated. It is and has always been doomed to failure. For those who have been grabbing onto the wrong end of the stick, that is, those who have sought to know, secure, and fulfill themselves outside themselves in a manic, often pointless, and more often destructive quest for more, rarely taking the time or making the effort to ask and find answers to the fundamental questions that every human being is bound to. Who am I? Why am I? Why is there anything? The wake-up call is indeed at hand. As I've made every effort to make clear in my book, our destiny does not depend on what is going around us, but is instead a function of what is emanating from us. No religion or belief system that is coming from outside ourselves can give us true self-knowledge. They can only serve to isolate us further in the falsehoods of the egoic mind and its processes. What we have been born to seek lies here and now in the sanctity of this very moment, beyond the unrelenting chatter of mind, in the silent presence of our own beingness. We are the prodigal son Jesus spoke to us of. We as a species are about to take the next great evolutionary step that will awaken those who are ready to their spiritual heritage and sacred birthright. This evolution in consciousness is clearly manifesting all over the world. That a more conscious humanity is being awakened is self-evident. It has been spurred on and supported by the technology of this glorious age of information, of which you are clearly an important part. America will find its place in this new age of information, but it has so much to offer in lessons learned. And so, Richard, I was delighted to see you step outside the box recently and quote some of the ancient prophecies that foretell of this time of great change and upheaval. I think I know you well enough to know you do not want to be known as another bug-eyed New Age prophet, and that your expertise is in finance and the global economy. But it is gratifying to see that you recognize nothing happens in a vacuum, that all things are connected, and that it would be short-sighted to separate the impending global economic collapse, the stunning increase in natural as well as man-made disasters, and those many prophecies as being nothing more than coincidence. It is what inspired me to write this letter. I realized I've touched on a lot here, and I'm not sure I've done much of a job at making any of my points absolutely clear. There are many gaps to be filled and much more to be explored. For anyone who may be interested, I believe my book can be of service to that end. Thank you, Richard, for your good work, and I wish you peace in the days to come. Stephen. Well, thank you for that, Stephen. Let me just repeat the title of the book once more. It's called The Big Book About Nothing. That's The Big Book About Nothing, currently available at Amazon.com. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if any of you would be interested in calling in to discuss that, I would be happy to take your calls, as always. And if not, we shall continue along our merry way. Well, I had an email about something else, which was part of something that I wrote as one of my emails to the distribution list that I have on file. All right, so let's continue with an email from John Dusmanis. John, okay, who says as follows. Hi, Richard. Just a quick note on something I noticed the past 2 weeks since the Greek debt item hit the fan in the media. I have been selling on eBay since January and have unloaded $18,000 worth of accumulated junk with much more to go. The past 4 months I have been selling magic lantern slides from the 1890 to 1920s period. Depending on condition, I start them from $1 to $10 opening bid. I have had 3 steady buyers, one in the UK and 2 in the Netherlands. I will list 20 to 30 slides at a time and sell 65 to 70%. Last week I sold only 4 out of the 30 and then to 3 Canadian buyers. The European buyers didn't bid at all. Normally they're good for 5 to 8 items each. One buyer in the Netherlands emailed an offer of 25 cents on the dollar for unsold items. They want items for their collection but are afraid to spend now. I have also been selling old tube audio amplifiers and tubes, UK term is valves. These items are going to Japan, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. When I have a rare new old stock item, prices are often in the hundreds of dollars. The long and short of it is, the Asian audio equipment market is still booming, and I must get out and find more of this old stuff. Last year, in a private non-eBay transaction, I unloaded two Western Electric theater sound systems with a spare power amplifier, unrestored, from the late 1920s, early 1930s time period to a Hong Kong collector for $40,000. He happily paid crating and shipping costs. What is also interesting, yesterday I sold another vintage old tube and the buyer's address in China was an engineering school. This has happened more than once. It looks like they will try to reverse engineer our old technology for their collectors. I don't know if this is of value to you, but it is an observation from the rail retail world as to where the money is and who is spending. Sincerely, John. Well, thank you for that, John. I'm sure there are buffs out there that have taken note of your every word. So then we come to Chris Fountain in New Haven, Connecticut. And Chris writes, Dear Richard, I know I'm a little late to the party, but your recorded broadcast of Memorial Day was excellent. I have listened to it a few times as I try to internalize all the information you passed on to us. Thank you. As for my questions, I'd like to start by asking if you think I will be able to tough it out here for a couple of years, as I'm about to start a graduate program. I realize that there are certain programs elsewhere. I'm looking into that for my PhD, but I'd like to do the MS degree here, if possible. I do not plan on going into debt to do it. That said, do you think my retail job as a national grocery chain that supports me while in school will be safe for the next 2.5 years? I am held in high esteem and feel secure, especially considering that we sell consumables. The company seems to be well run and is owned by a couple of the richest men in the world, so hopefully they can afford to weather the coming storm. When the time comes, what are your opinions as far as picking between the Scandinavian countries? I mentioned Sweden in my last email, and I will certainly consult the websites you've mentioned as well, but I would like your personal views on the differences in living between the countries. I realize that these questions are somewhat specific to me, but hope that there are others in similar positions who will benefit from your answers. All the best, Chris. First of all, your retail job in the national grocery chain is probably as good a job as you're going to get. So I would think that, especially if you're popular, and you do keep going despite the fact that you'll be in school, I would say that, all things being equal, it should be safe for 2.5 years. You're in the food distribution business. Food is what we all need, and we all need it to be distributed. So frankly, I think you're doing fine. I would hang on to that job. The only danger that I see is that they might want to replace you by someone who asks for less money, but other than that, should be okay. What else? The Scandinavian countries, they are all good bets, I would say. You have really found the right place if you like cold weather. I lived in Sweden for 2.5 years. I can tell you it's a very stable country. My friends were all Swedes who had lived for extended periods in other countries. I say that because the Swedes themselves tend to be somewhat insular, and certainly when I was there, many of them had not visited other countries, although everybody spoke fluent English, so that's a plus. But then in all of the Scandinavian countries, they speak fluent English, so that's not a plus for Sweden in particular. Norway, of course, has oil. Norway is an exceedingly rich country. I'm not sure these days how easy it is to get work or residence permits to these countries, but it's worth a try. And if you are, as I say again, interested in cold weather, because it is cold, and make no mistake about it, you are not going to find sunny climes for longer than about 6 weeks a year in those countries. Give it a go. Listen, I suggest they're great countries. I enjoyed my time in Sweden. I'd spent time in Denmark. I'd worked on a farm in Jutland, and the Danes are particularly friendly people, probably somewhat more friendly than the Swedes. If you don't know anything about Sweden, you do worse than watching an Ingmar Bergman movie. There are long silences, and I'm not sure that is to everybody's tastes. They are somewhat gloomy, but nevertheless, as I say, if you pick as your friends people who have lived in other countries, you should do fine. Do I think it will be possible for you to tough it out without getting completely drawn into the depression, Chris? I don't know. I have stated to people that I think those who are of a mind to move should be really thinking about making arrangements at this point. I'm afraid time is running out, and I mean that. Things are going to get drastically bad here. The states are running out of money. The municipalities are in dire trouble. People in education are being laid off by the droves right now. It's a very grim situation. Even that hallowed profession, the nursing profession, is beginning to suffer, which frankly I didn't think would happen. But I suppose I didn't give enough credit for the meanness of these pharmaceutical companies, which are pushing prices so high that people simply cannot afford to be sick, with all that that means. Doesn't do the medical profession any good, and especially the nursing profession. So, yes, I don't know quite what you meant by whether I thought everything would, whether you'd sort of be able to, as it were, tough it out. But if you have to tough it out, you must, Chris. But in the same time, in your moments off between school and the store, look into moving and do it fast. All right, Jaden Snyder had an email, and he said, Richard, perhaps you can provide some self-analysis for us, your listeners. I have often questioned your affiliation with the Progressive Radio Network. You don't strike me as progressive, given your absolute condemnation of governmental seizure of power and the way they pursue their ends without truth or transparency. In what sense do you consider yourself freedom-loving? Do you believe rights issue forth from our Creator? Given your disdain for American nation building, I would slot you right next to Rod and Paul. I'm not attempting criticism here. Is this accurate? Would it be fair to say that you rarely seem to criticize European societies? If given a clean sheet of paper for organizing government and society, how would you draw it? Would it have any resemblance to that which the Americans' founders laid out? Warm regards, James Snyder. James, thank you for the email. I am very grateful to you for allowing me the opportunity to perhaps stake my claim, whatever that might be. First of all, the words right next to Rod and Paul must be somewhat apt. My wife and I contributed really quite substantially to his campaign. In the last presidential elections, we felt very strongly that Ron Paul should be the next president, and haven't checked in recently with my wife, but I, for one, certainly believe that he should. I think it was a grave and horrifying miscarriage of democracy that he got shunted aside, that he got marginalized last time. I do think, unfortunately for him, that he doesn't sort of have the get-up-and-go character that seems to characterize American presidential candidates. I wish he did. I also, if this should be criticism, so be it, but I think he doesn't have as strong a grasp on the issues as he should have, especially the economic ones. But he goes further than anybody else in tackling the issue. So, frankly, of all of them, he is by far the best informed that I could make out during the campaign. It was, of course, I think, as I say, a miscarriage of democracy that he got completely ignored by the media and the powers that be. He got pilloried. He got mocked. Frankly, it was a shame. But I don't know what will happen next time. His son seems to be putting the proverbial foot in the mouth. I don't know where that will lead him, but anyway, okay, let's deal with the rest of this. Progressive, James, I don't know about these terms. I don't tackle politics, as you may know, as the listeners know well. My condemnation of the governmental seizure of power is, James, quite frankly, what you see they do with it. I mean, I don't know that this needs much discussion. Look what's happened to the way in which the governments have abused the seizure of the power that they have taken on. Is it not progressive to oppose that, James? I don't know. I have condemned the way they pursue their ends without truth or transparency, as you say. In what sense do I consider myself freedom-loving? Again, this is a kind of political term that I try to stay away from. I don't know what freedom is. I'm just interested right now in my slot in trying to arrest the process of decline. There isn't that much that I can do about it, and I think we have indeed passed the point of no return. I think that this is now the moment for Americans to throw out their hands and say, enough is enough, we are going somewhere else. I mean, that's what they did in Europe to come to the United States. Why should it be so anathema for Americans to have decided that this is Americans' turn to move on? And I'm quite sure that the enlightened people feel the way I do, and those who are even more enlightened will hopefully have taken steps. And if I have caused any one person to take those steps, then I feel, you know, I have been of use. Do I believe rights issue forth from our Creator? That is a question I cannot answer. Everybody has their own definition of who their Creator may be. There are as many different creators as there are people who believe in them. I don't know how to answer that. I think each person has their own definition of what their rights are, and I think for most people their rights are being abused in the United States of America right now, as I speak, day by day, week by week. What can you do? Nothing. We're past that point of no return. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be the one to promote social unrest and violence, and I don't know where one goes with this. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to sound so negative, James. I try to say it as it is here, to wake up people, to be the wake up call. You know, if you were given a clean sheet of paper for reorganizing government, I don't know how I would draw it. Again, I'm not a politician, you know. I think the American founders were great for their time, but I don't think they foresaw the kind of world in which we live today, which may make them obsolete. I don't know. Well, let me finish with an email from Steve Kruger. A little bit of a rant here. He says, Richard, with oil floating on top of the water in the Gulf, I would like to know if in the rain-making cycle, the water vapor evaporating from the surface will be taking oil up with the water vapor. If oil does go up into the clouds, then it will be spread with the rain. We will have a coating of oil everywhere. And if the oil doesn't go up with the water vapor, does that imply that the oil will prevent water from evaporating, causing less rain to fall? I know it's quite a bit off subject, but with a bit of luck, one of your listeners may have the answer. Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, I have read something about that rainy, oily rain has been seen coming down over Florida. It is a very serious consideration. I don't know anything about the science of this, but it all seems to make logical sense to me. Again, if there is somebody out there who knows what Steve is referring to and can shed some light, please be free, willing, and able either to send an email or to talk about this on Friday. I'm sure we'd love to hear about it. Oh, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. We've come to the end of another show. I'm very, very sorry. I'd love to go on talking, but I have to wrap it up. And so I will be back, as always, with another edition of the Wake Up Call this coming Friday. It remains for me, as always, to wish you a wonderful week ahead. Take care of yourselves. I'll be back on Friday, 10 a.m. As always, this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.